I went to school to become an engineer, and that's the degree that I have, and I went and studied engineering, but I went to a university I could not afford. I grew up out in Arizona. I went to a big public high school where, percentage-wise, a lot of people never even went to college, and if they did, it was a lot of community colleges and stuff, and I wanted a specific education at an Ivy League school, which at the time was mostly mocked, not supported. Including my guidance counselor thought it was just a dumb idea, but I went to Yale, and when I got to Yale, I couldn't afford it, and I literally got kicked out of classes the first week. I got called in, and they said, what part of you have to pay first was confusing you? And I said, I sent you all the money I have, and they said, it doesn't come close, even with aid and scholarships, and they said, you need to go home. So my first venture in entrepreneurship had nothing to do with being an entrepreneur. It had to do with solving a specific problem. I did not want to go home. So the options were find a way to make some money fast and consistently or go home. So I started my first software company my second week of college when I had no classes to go to anyway. And that's how I funded my education. And again, I never was thinking I want to be an entrepreneur. I just wanted to solve a specific problem, which turns out to be sort of relevant later because I never really went into entrepreneuring. What I went into for a living is problem solving. But I did go briefly. And I didn't really necessarily learn how to run a business. Because, by the way, it was a software company that I started as a college student, and I have never written a line of code, knew nothing about software. But I wrote a proposal, and the first proposal I wrote for a local contract that was out in the business community, I actually won, which was the most terrifying phone call I ever got. Was when they said, good news, you won. And I was thinking, how is this good news? Because now I'm expected to actually deliver something. I have no idea. So in a panic, I went out and posted signs all over, programmers and designers wanted, at the high school and on the university campus, and people called me. And I said, here, build this, and they did. And I said, what do you want for it? And they named embarrassingly low numbers. So the difference between that and what I was charging funded my college education. And so what I learned was simply that I learned the confidence that if you're resourceful enough, there's some way to solve a problem, even if at the beginning you have no idea how you're going to go about it. That's sort of what I got out of it, was my fear factor went down for the next time I was going to face something I didn't know how to do, because somehow I figured that out and I had no idea going in. I worked briefly in corporate America, but it did not go well. It just was a bad fit for me, the big engineering company I was at and the management that I worked for. So I left, and I've been doing startups. I left it in my 20s. I've been doing startups ever since. The first startup I built was a technology company that was acquired by American Express, so I had the first sort of company sale when I was 20-something, and I've been doing it ever since. Priceline was the fifth company startup that I was part of. Again, Priceline was a scratch startup. What we were just talking about, Jim, what we launched, what we set out to do, and what we wound up with looked very, very different from the way the story started to how it ended, but for those of you who don't know the company, just as of last week, I was actually proud of this, we're now in 180 countries. So Priceline is doing business in 180 countries for whatever, well, I guess we know the reason. Quarter after quarter, the company, from the beginning, we actually solved a real business problem that had a value equation that both sides of the food chain were willing to pay something for, in effect. So, you know, I say that because early in the internet days, the motto was, just give it away free and we'll figure out how to monetize it later. And even then I was saying, or you could just find something to do that people will actually pay you for and you'll never have to worry about that part. So as we know, many, many of those companies died. And our company, Priceline, has quarter after quarter doesn't just hit but seems to beat the street's estimates. So in the last 3 years, the stock went from 300 to, we were the first S&P stock ever to hit 1,000. Not Google, or it was supposed to be Apple before the split, or Google. But it turns out it was Priceline, not either of those, and the stock's at like $1,100 today, which gives the company, I know this sounds silly, I was just looking at it, and still hard to believe, but the company has a market value of $59 billion today. But we started it with about a third of the number of people that are in this room. Just a little group of people, an idea, and a little table of no money. And today it turned into, part of the reason I tell that when I go out and talk to people is they say, well, you have this big, global, multi-billion dollar company. No, we had a sheet of paper and an idea and some enthusiasm. So even though it's a $59 billion entity today, it was no different than anything in this room at the start. And I think that's important because sometimes people forget that every successful company started in the embryonic stage just like they're doing out here. But Anyway, that's kind of my background.
You just said something that scared the hell out of me. You said that it's wrong to give stuff away and then monetize it later?
Oh, no, I didn't say it was wrong.
Because I work for a media company.
That's what I didn't say it was wrong. I just said there are potentially better business models that you can employ.
All right. Let's start by having you define my favorite word, entrepreneur.
Sure.
Is it, you know, a career choice? Is it a lifestyle option? Is it a personality disorder?
I think it's a great and timely question. And you hit it exactly right. When I, years ago, which is why, by the way, I last year, just to put some perspective, last year I decided I wanted to take the year off to give back. And my method of giving back is mentoring entrepreneurs. And I set out last year just to spend the year mentoring entrepreneurs. But it wound up becoming entrepreneurship now, and then now back towards your question, is become a global phenomenon. On the drive here, I drove here from Cleveland. I had a meeting there yesterday. On the drive here, I did Skype, and I did Skype on my phone, by the way, which is kind of cool. I did Skype mentoring sessions driving to Cincinnati with entrepreneurs in East Africa, in Romania, and in Jamaica before I pulled up here onto 6th Street. That you could never do before, right? The world has changed so much. The fact that those people are now into, I'm talking to these guys in East Africa and Romania, and how do you even get into entrepreneurship? How do you even know the word? So when I was starting, I was the unstable guy, and you used the right word. It was a disease. People kept saying, what is wrong with you? Why can't you just get a job like everybody else, right? And I kept thinking, why is there not a job called problem solver? You see a problem in the world, you attack it. When you've solved it, you go solve another one. But here's what was happening. I would launch a company, and we were at one point on this run rate of about 3 to 4 years. Every 3 years, somebody, it seemed at that point, 3 to 4 years, my startups were getting acquired. And so people would see me, and they'd say, what are you doing? And I'd say this, and they'd say, well, you're doing something different last year. And I would say, yeah, the company got acquired. Now we're doing something new. And they would say, what is wrong with you? Why can't you just get a job like everyone else? So my crime was that people kept acquiring our startups, and I was always labeled as unstable. And it was many years later that I finally found out the name of my disease, which is called entrepreneurship. It turns out you actually can make a living just solving problems in the world, but it didn't exist then. And there weren't entrepreneurship programs at universities, and there weren't incubators, and there wasn't recognition that entrepreneurship is a business of solving problems, and when you successfully solve one, it's okay to go solve a different one. So I'm excited now that the term exists, but it certainly didn't, and that is my definition of it. It's everybody has an idea, everybody talks, entrepreneurs are the people that do something about it. Well, everyone's talking about a problem, they're the people that just go out and solve it.
Well, how important is it that the entrepreneur creates jobs or creates value for shareholders or generates profit for himself? Is it all about solving problems, or do you want to do these other things?
No, those things are the byproduct, I think. Those things are very important, but they're the byproduct. It's by the same token that when somebody says to me, I just want to be an entrepreneur, you're already off track, right? You're not an entrepreneur for the sake of being an entrepreneur. You're somebody that, in fact, it's sort of like when people come to me and they have an office, a table, chairs, and business cards, and I say, what are you doing? And they say, well, we don't know yet, but we have a company. Okay? That's backwards, right? The best entrepreneurs are the people that are going 1,000 miles an hour towards the problem, and you say, wait, back up. You couldn't even take money if someone gave it to you. You don't even have a bank account, right? And you don't have legal documents to be able to accept money. It's the people that are so focused on solving a problem that a business is this thing you have to wrap around yourself because you have to do that to solve the problem. It's not even what you're focused on. So I think that that's that sort of definition. And so when you do that, by definition, you wind up creating jobs and you wind up creating infrastructure, and those things are important, but it's not necessarily what you set out to do. You set out to solve a real problem in the world that benefits lots of people, and if you do it well, lots of people want your solution, which by definition creates jobs and profits. What's nice is the last couple of years, and as an entrepreneur, I would have never thought I'd be sitting here saying this today, but I'm doing a lot of work with the White House, the State Department, and governments around the world, and I hate politics, and I'm not particularly fond of politicians, because I just like to do stuff, not talk about stuff. But I'm going to give them this credit. Obama created the Office of Entrepreneurship and Innovation, which I advise him and the White House on. Hillary Clinton, before John Kerry, started a big global entrepreneurship program. And the same is true in governments all over the place. But here's why. They finally looked at the data, right? The data says that all net new job growth comes from businesses less than 5 years old. The State Department finally released that because big businesses said we created this many jobs in the last 5 years. What they didn't show you was the other number that says we lost more than we created. So it's a net negative in big business. But in the U.S., in the last 80% of all total jobs were created by small businesses and startups in the U.S. in the last 5 years, but 100% of all net new job growth was created by startups. So now everybody's finally saying entrepreneurship suddenly became cool in the U.S. and everywhere else because they said all these startups are creating all the jobs, nobody else is, so we better find a way to help them. So it is important.
Okay. What's your perception of Cincinnati's entrepreneurial?
You know, I'm just learning in these last few weeks. I bought a home in Ohio. So I've been spending more, like I just said, I've been on the sort of world tour of entrepreneurship. And I've been, like before here, I did Russia, Egypt, China, Austria, Malaysia, then Cleveland and Cincinnati. So I've been on a roll, but I bought a house in Northeast Ohio, and I'm an Ohioan now. So now I'm really interested, which is part of why I'm here when Daniel and I started talking about this. I'm learning a lot more, but it's impressive. I mean, facilities like this, this isn't any different than what you'd see anywhere else in the country or Silicon Valley. You need the co-working space. You need the mix of all you guys in the room, from mentorship to business angels to VCs to helping find customers. You know, it behooves Cincinnati for these people to succeed, right? We want great companies coming out of here that we can say, did you know that company was launched right here in Cincinnati? I went to Finland along the way. And Finland, Nokia's old news, Finland created Angry Birds, okay? They're particularly proud of the world's, you know, top-selling game ever for a game app coming out of Finland. Everybody wants to be part of sort of the new economy, the job creation, the value creation, but you got to do something about it. It doesn't happen unless we as a community surround these startups and help them get there. So it's great to see facilities like we're sitting in and see some of the funds in the area and some of the angel networks in the area. So I think all the activity that I've heard about that's going on here in Cincinnati is all going in the right direction.
You mentioned government intervention just a minute ago. How important is that to the equation? And the reason I ask is because in Cincinnati, it seems to me anyway, a lot of the energy here is business-led, you know, the centrifuge fund of funds, and a lot of the Fortune 500 companies that are involved in the formation of startups and encouraging their development. A lot of what we've got here is, I would say, private sector led. Does it have to be? Does it have to involve governments as well?
So it doesn't have to, but there is something they can do to help. Sometimes, I mean, you guys will get a kick out of this. I not long ago was asked to brief members of Congress on small business and American competitiveness and innovation. So I got to, since I'm now a resident, I opened this congressional thing, and you know, it's very daunting when you see on TV, because they're all up there and you're down here when you testify before them, but I said innovation is alive and well, and then I paused and I said, in Ohio, which I was fun to get to do because that was not what they thought I was going to say. Our senators obviously love that, but it's, you know, every great ideas are not, you know, inherent to Silicon Valley or anywhere else. Our people are just as smart right here in Ohio as they are anywhere else. What they do better is they do have an infrastructure where everybody in the community cares about the success of startups. We have to evolve to that a little bit more. So that said, that does include government, and I'll give you some examples. I didn't see this in Cincinnati, but when I was just in Cleveland, there is a facility called the Launch House, which is a startup space like Centrifuge is here. Not exactly the same, but the great part of the story was it's in Shaker Heights, Ohio, and the city gave them a building. So I tell you what, the city owns this building, no charge, we know you don't have any money. What if we give you entrepreneurs this building that no one's using anyway, right? Because what you'll create will be of more value to Ohio and to the Cleveland area than what we would get just selling this to one private business. That's an example. That's local government. But a city said, let's help out. Let's just give them a building at no cost so that they have some place to come to every day to do their startups, because a lot of these startups couldn't pay rent. As you move up on a state level, obviously Ohio with Third Frontier and a lot of things that Ohio does, I'm on the board of Jumpstart in Cleveland, but that's an entity funded by the state to give money to early stage startups that would never get money from VCs. So again, that takes state money to do that, because that's where the money comes from. If you go to the next level, on the federal level, they're trying. There are times, though, where, you know, the government said to me, what can we do to help? And my answer was just stay the hell out of our way and don't impede us is the best thing that you could do. But there clearly are things. There are immigration laws that are relevant to talent coming in and out of the country. We all need talent. The scarcest resource for a startup, by the way, is not money. It's talent, right? There's way more people that can write a check than there are people that can co-found a company with you and help you build the thing, especially when you can't pay them yet, right, when you don't have money. So talent is the hard thing. What we don't want is talent leaving, whether it's leaving Ohio, leaving Cincinnati, or leaving the country, and we don't want to prevent really talented people that want to come here and help. So there's immigration laws. They're on a federal level. Obviously, things that the government that matter a lot, like the crowdfunding Startup Act, the Startup Act, the Startup 2.0, and the crowdfunding bill. Those are all things that require government involvement. And so I guess, you know, one of the things I said that I thought would end my congressional session fast, I thought it would just get thrown out, because I gave an example of a business trying to help a customer it knew nothing about, right? And they all nodded because it was a pretty obvious example of a business trying to service a customer that it didn't know at all. And then I delivered the punchline, which was, I said, so I told that story to say to you guys, how are you going to sit here in Congress and help entrepreneurs at all when not anybody in this room even knows one personally? You know nothing about startups. You don't know what our battles are. You don't know what we face. You don't come visit us. You don't ever leave this building. So how are you going to help a customer that you don't even know? So we need their help. We need them to get a little bit more involved. And I've said that everywhere from the White House to the Capitol, because there are things like those bills that we need them for.
What cities do you think are doing startup the best, the startup community?
Well, you know, it's in pieces. For example, if any of you have seen 1871 in Chicago, they did a really good job. Chicago kind of said, we get the, and again, I don't believe that Silicon Valley has a patent on creativity or anything. What they did, though, they did do some things we should learn from, right? They did, for example, the social aspect of business development, they did really well. And I'm going to tell you, the first time, tough love, I'm going to be honest, the first time I came to Ohio, so let me tell you a quick story. I was in Silicon Valley, and I was trying to meet with all the people that wanted a meeting, and I ran out of time. I had five people left that wanted to pitch something to me, and I had only dinner left. So I did something that I could probably not do anywhere else. I sent an email simultaneously to all five of them. I said, I know none of you know each other, and you all want to pitch something to me, but I only have dinner left. So I can get one of you, and four of you I can never get to, or you can just all meet me for dinner, and we'll just go around the table. Instantly, everyone, without a thought, said, sure. They showed up, they sat around a table. When each person gave their pitch to me, everybody said, oh, you know what? You should meet so-and-so. They were writing notes. They were all helping each other. And I'll bet you haven't seen this, and I could help you with that. They were all training, because their idea was, let's all win. Then I came literally from there, and it wasn't Cincinnati, but it was Ohio, but I went into Cleveland, and I started to schedule meetings, and I got a response that was very on the opposite end. They not only did they not want anyone else to hear what they were doing, but some people didn't want to tell me. Let me get this straight. It's a big secret. You want me to write a check, but you're not going to tell me what the business is. Yes, sir. And I said, I'll get my checkbook right out. I mean, seriously? Right? Because people are like, I don't want anyone to steal my idea. So I came to Ohio and found a more competitive, paranoia type of environment. I'm overgeneralizing, but I'm just telling you my experience. People wouldn't sit in a room together. People were saying, well, can I meet with you when he leaves? Because I don't want him to hear my idea. And I'm thinking, he might be able to help you with this idea. You're short resources. Maybe you guys could trade. Maybe people should talk to each other a little bit more. So there are, when you ask who's doing it well, it's in different stages in different places. On the other hand, we're seeing a lot more entities in Ohio like this, a lot more incubators, a lot more business angel involvement, business plan competitions. I've judged a couple in Ohio in just the last month. It depends on where you ask me. You'll see different elements of it. Some places the local community's involved. Some places the government's involved. Some places the entrepreneurs have a place like in Chicago to work. I think there's pieces of success everywhere, but you got to look outside your own city to see who's doing something right. I always tell people, take a trip. You know, if somebody lives in Cincinnati, go visit 1871 in Chicago for a day. I'm not saying they're doing everything perfect, but they're doing some really cool stuff that we should come back to Cincinnati and say, okay, what things did they do that we could do here that would help us? but would not. I'm very editorial opinion, not seeing enough of that. Too many people are just sort of staying in their building in their city, doing it their way, and failing to adopt, in some cases, the Silicon Valley model of collaborative development. That makes sense?
We have a lot of advisory services available, incubators, accelerators, you name it, we have a way to help startups. What should startups be demanding of these providers, of these service providers? What should they be looking for?
Okay, so I'll tell you the thing that, again, I've spent the last 2 years just sort of visiting all those places, but all over the world. I'm going to tell you guys what I think is the differentiator and the scarcest resource, and that's mentorship. So if you get a room full of people who don't know how to run a business and all the rest of the people in the room have never run a business either, guess what's missing? The experience in how to run a business. Even if somebody came in and said, here's a check, they don't know what to do with that money, right? The great fallacy of investment is most of these companies wouldn't know what to do with the money if they got it, even though they spent every day asking for it, right? They've never managed money. They don't have a financial background. They don't know what to do. So the piece to me that I think is missing, that if I was building a startup today in any of these incubators, that I would ask for more of is local business community mentorship. Sometimes business leaders in a community say, well, I'm not an entrepreneur, I never did a startup. You know how to run a business. You know a million things that person in that room has never done before and does not know. Your business knowledge and experience is very valuable. You don't have to be a former entrepreneur to be a good mentor. So I think that's what's missing. They sit in the room and I listen in on the meetings, and people say, I don't know, I've never done that either, right? Because it's two, new entrepreneurs or whatever, inexperienced people, and what they need is one of us at this table, someone to walk in the room and say, actually, I have done that a lot of times, right? And I can give you some tips on how to do that. So mentorship is the thing that worries me most, that if I were them, and they do ask for that most. And by the way, it's the, it's a lot easier to stroke a check than it is to spend an afternoon of your time sitting in the room with these people trying to help them solve a business problem. It's the most valuable thing you can give is not money, it's time. And that's the one thing none of us have. So everybody always tells me I'm busy, right? And that's what we say all the time. And I think, you know what? If a couple people during my career hadn't said, I'm busy, but I'm going to make the time for you anyway, I don't know if I could have done a bunch of stuff that I did. So I intentionally try to make time to mentor entrepreneurs because somebody did that for me. And if we don't find a way to keep paying, and I tell them, when people say, thank you so much for your time, I say, don't thank me. Just remember the day somebody asks you for help, no matter how busy you are, that's the way you pay that debt forward. Find time to help someone else when it's your turn to do that. But mentorship, we just have to do it.
Just to let everybody know, there will be time for questions at the end of this, but I wanted to ask some questions about your career. Starting with, I want you to relate your most memorable near-death business experience.
Well, there's been plenty of those. I heard this expression the other day that I've been living my whole life. I just didn't hear it described so aptly. But an entrepreneur is somebody who jumps off a cliff and then tries to build an airplane on the way down, if you haven't heard that expression. And my whole life I've been plummeting off cliffs, looking around saying, ooh, I should have looked before I jumped, right? But maybe there's still time to build an airplane before I splat, and sometimes you splat. That's entrepreneurship because of the risk-taking element of it. So by definition, since we've jumped off a lot of cliffs, sometimes we didn't build an airplane on the way down and we splatted. I've had a few just complete failures, things that we were just so excited about. I'll give you probably a pretty easy to comprehend example. So I had this crazy idea that one day you wouldn't go to the mall. This is obviously years ago. You wouldn't go to the mall. You would go to your computer to buy a sweater from Nordstrom's. And so we spent all the time, energy, and money and built this whole online buying solution. And then it was just crickets chirping and dead silence. No consumers showed up at all. And it was just a miserable failure because while the idea was right, it was probably 5 or 6 years ahead of its time. Every consumer, we said, it's the same sweater. You're going to drive to the mall and buy. So we rationally couldn't understand why nobody wanted to do it. And people said, wait, you want me to type my credit card number into your screen? I don't think so. And then they said, I kind of want to try the sweater on. And we kept on saying, you buy the same brand and the same size every time you go there. And people said, I know, but I still like to touch it and feel it. Nobody was ready. And you know, the near death was the day you have to call everyone into the room and say, we're shutting down because no one, we have no buyers. And then calling investors and saying, yeah, all that money that you gave us to build this thing, you know, it ain't coming back. We spent it all and we got nothing. So when you hit those moments, those are, tell you guys another funny test, considering what week it is right now that it's November. Now, many years later, I call this the Thanksgiving test. I can tell if someone's close to one of those near-death experiences because I say, are you excited about Thanksgiving? And some of the startups say, I'm not going home. And I already know it's because the business is failing and all the relatives that they took friends and family money from will be at a table like this and staring at them. So how's the business? And they want to say, yeah, about that. You know, while you pass the cranberries, I meant to tell you all your money's gone and I'm shutting the business down. Right? Ones that don't want to go home for Thanksgiving don't want to face the friends and family round. The ones that can't wait are doing really, really well. And I noticed that by accident, but it turned out to be really true. When I'd say, are you excited about Thanksgiving? Everyone that said no, it's because their business was failing. Because I remember that. I didn't even want to go home to tell everybody all the money was gone and we just blew it. We missed. We were too soon. Whatever the reason is, we missed and we failed.
Well, how do you know when it's time to quit?
Okay, so that's a really important question that I did not know. So here's what I counsel people now. Because later, I sat in a meeting, and it was at the end of a year, and I had the investor and the entrepreneur there. And I said, so how did it go? And simultaneously, he said great, and he said horrible. And I said, well, you guys are in the same company. You spent the same year with the same money building the same thing. And the entrepreneur said, I think all things considered, given what we faced, we did pretty well. And the investor said, I think it's a miserable failure because I thought you were going to be here at this point. And I said, wait, time out. What did you guys expect at the end of a year? And they gave me two different answers. And I realized what happened to me in that company was what most people do. You launch, you go, you hammer, you nail, you saw, you build. And at the end of the year, you look around and you say, we built this store and nobody came to it. That's the first time you say it appears to be failing. So the lesson now, what I mentor entrepreneurs, is on day one with all stakeholders, entrepreneurs, investors, and everybody else in the room, what we do is we go to a whiteboard and we say, let's write in black and white, we're going to print this and sign it. What does success look like? At 6 months, at 1 year, at 18 months, and what does failure look like? You know what I tell my employees when I do startups now? I tell them that we are pre-firing ourselves, right? We're going to say right now that at the end of a year, success looks like this. We have 10,000 new users, this much revenue, version 2 of the software, we have 12 servers, whatever it is, the more quantifiable, the better. So at the beginning, we say, at this checkpoint, these things make this a success. Anything less than them, we agree is a failure. And somebody will say, well, what if we hit 80% of that? And we say, let's have that argument now, not in a year when the money's gone. So we argue about, we all say, this is the minimum. Anything below this is an agreed upon failure, and everyone in the room nods. So I even tell the team, if we get there and this is the number, I shouldn't have to walk you out. You should be packing your desk and saying, I know, I'm fired, I didn't make it. All right, there shouldn't be a discussion because you agreed to those numbers and we didn't make them. And then there's a middle one, right? If this is pretty good and if we do this, wow, you know, this is fantastic. But you got to set that baseline of what success and failure look like. The other thing that prevents is getting all the way to the year and then looking back and saying, wow, we blew it and all the money's gone. At this rate, you can break that back into quarters. And by second quarter, we're at 30% of the goals we should be at for second quarter. We don't need to wait to the end of the year to see that this is failing. So what we do a quarterly check. And we go in and we say, we all agree, because we agreed before we started this calendar year, what success and failure look like, we are failing. Now, the question is it something we can fix? If it is, we fix it and go another quarter and see if it looks like we're catching up. And then we agree again. We might actually go back and modify that chart because we learned something, but we all sign it again. If it's not something we can fix, then that's the point where you say, guys, it ain't working. And as painful as this is, it's a lot less painful in May than it is in December, right, when we spent the rest of the year's money. So we've gotten very disciplined about drawing success. Everybody agrees to it. We check it every month. We meet quarterly. And we either make course adjustments or we admit that it ain't working and we go home way before we've spent all the money. A really important discipline, and I did not know that then.
You opened this conversation by describing entrepreneurship as problem solving. So what problem are you most motivated to solve? What are you going to do before you're career is over?
You know, now, for me, it changes. And by the way, I'll say this again to the entrepreneurship thing. So this past year, I was the commencement speaker at two universities in the U.S. and one over in Europe. And I was pretty sure it was going to be a lynch mob because I told parents, not students, at graduations, like I did Kent State University in the Cleveland area, and it's, you know, that university has 42,000 students. It's a big university. And when I went in the auditorium, there were thousands of people, and I said, I'll never get out of here alive after I say what I'm going to say. So what I told the parents is, the old model of everything you tell your kids to do with their life is wrong, so please quit saying that. They don't want your life. They are not trying to be you. It doesn't mean they don't love their mother and their father. They just don't want to be you. And the whole world they live in is different. So I say all that to say that the model is you go to college, you get a degree, you're an engineer. So by graduation, everyone's saying, what are you going to do with your life? As if a 22-year-old knows that in hindsight? And then the worst part, whatever you decide, I got an engineering degree, fine, you are an engineer. That is your label for the rest of your life. You made a decision, you're an engineer, and you have to be that. It's absurd in today's world. My whole life, I've done everything in 2 to 3 year increments. But imagine if I had said to my parents after graduation, what are you going to do with your life? I don't know, I'm going to do this for the next couple of years and then check with me then. And when I was stupid enough to say that, people said, what, are you nuts? What is your plan? I had long-term goals, but I had short-term tactics. So every 2 or 3 years, I reassess, how am I doing? Am I doing anything useful in the world? Am I doing anything interesting? Am I growing? If I'm not, then I'm going to get off the path I'm on and change. So I say all that to say that I went through a phase of launching companies. And people say, what do you do for a living? I launch companies. Now I'm at a point in my life where my passion is launching entrepreneurs. So when someone says, you still launching companies? I say, no, I'm launching entrepreneurs. That is a very different business. What that means is, what we do in the investment community today, these people in this room give us a business plan. We flip to the back page first and look at the financials. And we say, this is a bad business idea. It's not going to make money. So we're done, and we discard that entrepreneur. You may have just discarded somebody whose next 5 companies are going to be unbelievable. So the analysis we do is on the projections and on the business. I don't do that anymore. I look at the business, but that's not what I'm investing in or what I'm betting on. See, your business needs work. I'll help you with that. But, you know, he's amazing. And I want to help him become a lifelong serial entrepreneur that's successful. So now the effort we used to put into analyzing spreadsheets, we put into analyzing entrepreneurs. And we say sometimes the opposite. This is a good idea, but I don't think this guy's really committed. I don't think he has the resources, the savvy to do it, or the opposite. Sure, her business plan is probably weak and there's probably something else, but I put her in charge of anything I was building. So we're now spending our time investing in building, developing, supporting, inspiring, everything we can do around the great entrepreneurs that we meet, because over the rest of their career, they will create much value, create many jobs, and help us.